This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today we have a guest with us who has played a quiet but very important and very special role in things like the Mars Face Project and a really serious look into what our real history has been, dating back to way before the oldest civilizations that we have any record of. Mark Carlotto has been for over 40 years involved in space-related applications involving remote sensing, mapping, image processing, pattern recognition, machine learning, and related technologies. He has a PhD in electrical engineering from Carnegie Mellon. He has written over 100 technical and scientific papers, 9 books. He was an adjunct professor at Boston University in the 80s, and he taught courses in computer architecture, image processing. He has been on quite a journey as an independent scientist, which he and I have a lot to talk about, because he was involved in the original imaging of the Mars face before NASA made it. Well, we'll talk about it in a few minutes. Ann and I financed the initial work that he did, and out of it came his book, The Martian Enigmas. And we're going to talk about the truth about this, because this truth has been completely, brilliantly, and terrifyingly covered up. Mark Carlotto, welcome to Dreamland.
Willie, thanks very much.
Well, it's such an extraordinary pleasure to see you again. We were talking just before we started, folks, and Mark and I have not seen each other since we were together at Bruce Maccabee's house. It must have been in the late 80s or early 90s.
I think so. And it was, I think it was after, soon after the book Communion came out, around that time, I think.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to remember who introduced, and I think I do remember who introduced me to you. It was a space scientist who was, he was going to be the first Mars astronaut until...
Brian O'Leary.
Brian O'Leary, that's right. Yeah. Brian O'Leary, until he discovered that they planned to send him alone. And he thought, maybe this mission isn't going to work, which might have been correct. And he pulled out. Dick Hoagland introduced me to the Mars face. And I began to want to do some serious imaging on that. And that's how you came into my life. And I think it was through Brian. And then...
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, we worked together. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Brian's PhD actually was in the optical properties of Mars. And so what I was working on at the time was a method for computing 3D models from images. Stuff that's, more routine nowadays. But, having a knowledge of the surface and the physics, how, light reflects off of Mars was important. So we worked together on a couple of papers. One of the papers was published in Applied Optics that showed that phase wasn't a trick of light and shadow, as NASA had been saying repeatedly. So we showed that that was not the case. We worked together for a number of years.
Now, let's cut to the second image that they took, the closer image. I remember emailing you about that image because it looked like the ground form had been disturbed. What happened there? Why does the second image look just like a pile of rocks, basically? The closer image
What happened was... This was many years later, when they finally got around to reimaging it, and they took the first opportunity and it was in the wintertime on Mars, and the sun was at a low angle, and it was almost like, you know, if you hold a flashlight under your face and you light your face that way, it looks spooky. But you know, with the face on Mars being a formation, it had a lot of unusual characteristics, and it wasn't immediately obvious what it was. And so because of that, you know, NASA said, well, this is just, you know, obviously it's just a pile of rocks, and they finally did bury it at that point. You know, I analyzed that picture in some detail, and I tried to get the work published, but the community was not, even the alternative science community was not even willing to accept it at that point. It was like, NASA did a really good job of burying it.
I'm going to have a man on Dreamland in January, I think, who has gathered hundreds and hundreds of images from Mars and the Moon that NASA has airbrushed. Hundreds of them. In other words, they make sure that we don't see certain things on the Moon and Mars. Why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, get a chance to talk about my more recent work. This is really a common theme, Whitley, that, you know, scientists and academics like to keep things in the box. They don't like to explore new possibilities because they're interesting. Only when push comes to shove are they willing to do. And generally, it's when there's so many anomalies, so many situations that sort of come about and break the rules, that they're willing to, you know, change the paradigm. And so when there's a few cases, they tend to sort of marginalize them. It's really a very common behavior. I just recently had another paper. I was trying to publish a paper. I'm still trying to publish a paper on a buried structure in Egypt. And there's very good evidence suggesting that it's there. It's called the Labyrinth. And Herodotus talked about it, you know, 500 BCE. It was, he said it was more grand than the pyramids, but it threatens, you know, mainstream Egyptology. And, you know, this is, again, it's another, you know, we started talking about Mars, but it's a theme that actually runs through anything that pushes the boundaries of science.
Well, what happens is they fall into the trap of defending their beliefs rather than doing research.
That's right.
And that's where Egyptology is, I think it's failed. I think Egyptology is a failed science, frankly.
They're trying.
I just can't be able to describe it.
I think so, because they've already defined the ground rules. It's like there was really nothing before the Egyptians other than, you know, primitive people. They kind of dismissed the dynastic, you know, evidence of earlier civilizations that, you know, I believe were really the ones responsible for at least the original structures at Giza and perhaps even the Labyrinth. But, you know, once you decide what the ground rules are, then it becomes more political than scientific.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. These are very fine, beautifully educated and sincere people, but they have drifted into the same trap that the pre-Galileo, or the, I should say, yeah, well, that science as it was, as insofar as it existed then, had drifted into before Galileo and Copernicus and people like that came along.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's too bad. It really is, because we need them more than ever now. We need to know what really happened. And, you know, before Atlantis, and Beyond Atlantis, the two books you've written on Atlantis are quite amazing. I have to admit, sadly enough, I don't have much information on Beyond Atlantis, but I have read before Atlantis very carefully and in detail. Let's go to one of the most extraordinary things in Before Atlantis is the long lists of sites that point to directions other than true north. And there are large numbers of them grouped together, all pointing at a direction that no longer has any meaning. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's about?
Yeah, I mean, if you give me a few extra minutes, I can give you the, how it all started.
Sure.
I wasn't really looking for anything important or significant. I was looking at Google Earth. We're going to Mexico on vacation, and I wanted to visit some of the sites. So, I'm looking at Chichen Itza and other places. And it's like, why aren't they aligned to north? And I hadn't really, thought about any of this stuff before. And it wasn't just a few sites. Not very, very little in Mexico is aligned to the cardinal directions. And I thought, well, okay, maybe it's aligned to solstices, to the moon in different ways. And it turned out that none of those cases were the case. And so I remembered this idea of pole shifts that Charles Hapgood had proposed back in the 50s. Because it actually came up in the Mars investigation. Do you remember Tom Van Flandern? He was an astronomer that was involved with the Mars research. He actually proposed that there's very good evidence that Mars poles have shifted significantly. It was because when the Tharsis volcano, as that built up, it was such an imbalance on the crust, such mass there that the moments of inertia shifted. Anyway, prior to that, he argued and showed, the data isn't very good, but showed that the face and the city were aligned in the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. Dick Hoagland, showed that it could have been aligned to a solstice back, half, was it 250,000, I forget, 250,000 years ago, something like that. In any case, the whole idea of pole shifts kind of got started on Mars, and I remembered this. And it's like, I wonder if any of these sites in Mexico pointed to previous poles. I got Hapgood's book, and he had found a few positions. And sure enough, like Teotihuacan, north of Mexico City, lines up perfectly to the Hudson Bay pole. This was the pole supposedly before the current pole existed. And so this got me going. And I became a bit of a lunatic with Google Earth. I didn't have any automatic software, but I'm drawing lines from, with the ruler tool from an object all the way up to these poles. And it's like, I'm up like all night doing this. And I find tons of sites. Anyway, that's how the research got started. And later on, I actually did a systematic study. I've done several. And the evidence is... It's interesting, and I don't know why archaeoastronomers don't, haven't talked about this, but most of these sites are not aligned in any known ways. But when you bring in other poles, almost all of them can be explained. And so this was kind of like my epiphany.
And in the book, for example, I'm just looking at sites aligned to the Norwegian Sea Pole. There's a whole huge list of them. Abydin in Israel, Dendera, Edfu, Como Omo in Egypt, Shunet, Tulum in Mexico, Uxmal, Templo Major in Mexico, it's Chan Chan in Peru, Hatusa in Turkey, all over the world, all aligned. And you can tell when these probably were built by figuring out when the pole might have been there when they were built. Is that correct?
So what I was sort of working on at the time was just sort of the geometry or the geography, I should say. If you put a pole in different positions, how many sites does that explain? And I was actually able to refine Hapgood's original polls. He had come up with three previous ones. I found four. And with those four, I could account for pretty much all the sites. I did not have a dating for them, though. Hapgood had dated using climate data. Then someone contacted me, and this is why, you know, the internet and just, you know, modern tech is so great, because you can work with people anywhere in the world, and they find you, and if you have, you know, rapport, common interests, you work together. Anyway, he had a background in environmental science, and he showed that he actually came up with some data. I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted. My grandkids are here, and they're running wild through the house.
That's okay. That's okay. We, some of us also have grandkids, so.
Okay. I'm going to try to ignore it. Anyway, what he was able to research were papers that had been written finding it was a fossil data, seemingly a plate fossil data showing like in these bone caves in the United Kingdom, some caves actually had evidence of animals that lived in subtropical or tropical climates, like rhinoceros and hyenas, you know, more arid climates. And then other caves had evidence of like the Arctic fox and the, you know, mammoth and other animals that are more cold weather. And anyway, you know, the United Kingdom is not a large area, but in these different caves, it showed just a tremendous diversity of fossils from, you know, different climate zones. Using this information, his name is Mark Gaffney. He actually came up with the original dating for these poles, which actually corresponded quite nicely with Hapgood's. Again, I found an extra one. You know, based on that, we had a chronology. And that chronology takes us back to about 130,000 years ago, where the oldest pole that we've analyzed existed, that was in the Bering Sea, north of the Aleutian Islands. And then it shifted from there to northern Greenland. From there, it shifted to, mentioned, the Norwegian Sea. From there to Hudson Bay, and from there to the Arctic. So we had a chronology, we had the geography, and now we could, you know, come up with some new datings for these sites. And they were, you know, much older than archaeologists, you know, accept. And I was at a conference presenting this information, and someone said to me, you know, your presentation was really interesting. You presented a lot of data, but you lost your audience once you started talking about the dates. I says, well, what do you mean? He said, well, what you should do is you should change your theory to make the dates more in line with what we already know. And I said, okay, thank you very much. And, you know, that's probably the last time I'll speak to that group. But, you know, this is typical. You have people that think in terms of the box. You present them with data. You can't argue with a statistic, so you argue, you know, you dispute the interpretation of it. So this is ongoing right now with me.
There's a disconnect. Well, let me give you an example. What is the date of the Norwegian Sea pole?
So the Norwegian Sea pole was about 75,000 years ago. So at that point, let me give you a little context. Have you heard of this enormous supervolcanic eruption called Toba, T-O-B-A?
Maybe I have and maybe I haven't, but I'll bet you not many of my audiences have. So why don't you tell us about it?
So this is like a VEI-8 event, tremendously powerful, the most powerful eruption on Earth in the last 100+ thousand years. It was considered an extinction event where you know, many species either died out or almost died out, including humanity. And the timing of this coincides with the Norwegian Sea pole, with what we believe was a pole shift from Greenland to the Norwegian Sea. And there were other things that happened. There were geomagnetic disturbances, like kind of like what we're seeing now. And in fact, it was something called an excursion where the pole where the magnetic field collapses and could possibly even, excuse me, could reverse itself. And this, and then following this, there were eruptions and major cataclysmic events, and we believe the pole shift. So this was at a time when evidently human populations were decimated, yet at some point after that, we're finding sites in certain parts of the world that were built in alignment to that pole. And you mentioned some of them.
Yes.
It actually turns out that the number of sites that I've been able to find draw precipitously at this point after this eruption during this period of time, and then later on increased again, which is very interesting. Again, it's circumstantially corroborating that.
We're recovering.
Yeah, yeah. So,
Here's the thing that, when I talk to conventional archaeologists about ideas like this, they say 75,000 years ago, there is no evidence of any habitations that would support the kind of populations needed to create the temples and so forth that these people, as they call you, and they call me these people too, on a different level. In any case, are claiming were there. In other words, the people and the places that they needed to live in didn't exist and didn't happen. The people were very primitive. So how could these sophisticated sites have been built?
Yeah, then again, lack of evidence doesn't necessarily mean. How does it go? Doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that you haven't found it yet. Now, they'll roll their eyes with that. It's a little tricky because you don't have all the answers. So you're dealing with, incomplete information, but the information that you do have, on the other hand, can't be explained by these same archaeologists using any conventional theory, because it's like how the primitive Stone Age people all of a sudden within a few thousand years start erecting structures like the Giza pyramids. Where's the evolution in the technology? What happens in Egypt, as is that the most sophisticated structures are the oldest, and then it declines, it decreases, which is counterintuitive to how anthropology says, humankind has developed. We've gotten, increasingly more sophisticated. Yet there appears to be these dips. So maybe there's dips, there's rises and falls. And that's really the whole idea behind my book, Before Atlantis, is that there's been a series of them, four of them, in fact, over the last 100,000 years.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we will be right back.
Did we misunderstand the teaching of Jesus? Perhaps a long time ago, perhaps almost as soon as he rose from the dead, we mistook him for something that he may not have been. But we do know one thing, he was one of us. His life and his resurrection reveal the power of the good in all of us. And his teaching shows anybody, whether they have religious beliefs or not, how to find that goodness and live it. Get Jesus a New Vision. It's available as an audio book. It is available as a paperback and as a Kindle. Get it today.
We're talking to Mark Carlotto, his website, markcarlotto.com. We are talking about his book, Before Atlantis, but go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you will find Mark has written many books, and the absolutely seminal book on Mars, the Mars Face. And so it's an extraordinary output, it really is. Now, what, Mark, what when the poles shift, what's the difference between the pole shift as you conceived of them and Hapgood conceived of them and polar wander, which is an established scientific geological fact?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, plate tectonics is based on the idea that the Earth's crust is divided into these plates that sort of move independently. And based on the science that has verified that to be the case, it's basically, you know, paleomagnetic data, magnetic field recorded in volcanic rock that hardens, and when it hardens, the direction of the magnetic field at the time is sort of frozen. Using this information, they can piece all this together and figure out how the continents have wandered and so forth over time. And it shows that there are systematic shifts in the crust that occur over a very long period of time. What Hapgood proposed was that instead of this happening, you know, plate tectonics and actually plate tectonic theory hadn't even been formally accepted in Hapgood's time. But he felt, based on, again, not geological information so much, but climate data, that it appeared that different parts of the world suddenly entered and left, you know, polar climates. And so, you know, this corresponds with the movement of ice sheets and so forth that have been mapped. Based on sort of the climate data, he proposed that there's got to be something else going on. So it wasn't a geological argument. So, and this is kind of the tricky part, because it's not a geological argument, or the motivation wasn't, but it is geology. It's like, okay, so, you know, how do you explain it? No one, he proposed that it was a buildup of ice that caused the, you know, the moment of inertia of the Earth's crust to change, sort of like on Mars. But with the Tharsis, the volcano that caused, you know, the Mars poles to shift. This is accepted. It's not accepted that Earth's poles shift in the way that Hapgood described it. So, what you know he proposed was that it was a build of ice. Albert Einstein actually, who was alive at the time, he analyzed Hapgood's work, and he said, yeah, I don't think there's enough mass up there to cause this to happen. I actually did an analysis, part of a paper I published a few years ago, where I come up with a new version of Hapgood's theory based on some other mechanisms. And I actually show that the amount of ice that we think was present at the last glacial max would have moved the pole only, you know, just a short distance based on changes in the moment of inertia. But what I came up with, and it's, you know, it's speculative and it's tentative, is another way this could work. And that is that we talk about these geomagnetic changes we're, you know, experiencing now, where the compass calibration, you know, north, true north to magnetic north, has to be updated, you know, fairly regularly, because the magnetic pole is moving. Evidently this occurs or can occur preceding what are called geomagnetic excursions, where the magnetic field will start to break down, weaken poles. They don't maintain their integrity. And the field collapses. And in some cases, it's evidence that it actually reverses itself. So the north magnetic pole becomes the south and vice versa. So the theory that I proposed was that when this occurs, if the field reverses, then the magnetism of the crust is opposite that of the core. And that could cause the crust to become unlocked. So whereas, you know, the crust is sort of floating on the mantle, which is, you know, molten, and there's obviously movement because it's, you know, the plates are moving. But this becomes much more freely moving when the field reverses. And when this occurs, tidal forces of the sun and moon, primarily the moon, could over a period of time cause the crust to move. Same way that the moon moves the Earth's ocean, it would move more slowly, but decidedly would move the Earth's crust. And so this is the mechanism I actually proposed. Sorry, that's a little
fabulous. But I just have a question I want to kick in here.
Yeah.
The crust moves, wouldn't we see a lot of disruption on the surface, earthquakes and even mountain ranges changing form and so forth? But I don't think we see that.
Well, so this doesn't normally happen, and it hasn't happened yet. But I believe there's been four episodes over the last 130,000 years where it did happen, and there was a crustal shift. And one of these times was during the time of the Toba eruption, 75,000 years ago, the Norwegian Sea Pole. And there's been other eruptions that have taken place and other geomagnetic reversals. And I don't have them committed to memory. I can, you know, I'm Italian. I can use my hands just so much, but I need charts, and I don't have any charts right now. It's all right. The point is, it's all in the book. And what's interesting is that there are things that seem to occur around the same time. Geomagnetic anomalies, volcanic eruptions, and what appear to be pole shifts. And these are correlated with changes in the global sea levels, which relates to the amount of, inversely related to the amount of ice at the poles. So as ice at the poles melt, global sea levels rise. And this happens when the poles shift because, it's happening now largely because of the increase in carbon dioxide. But during the last glacial max, the hypothesis, Hapgood's hypothesis, was that the Earth, that the North Pole, the geomagnetic pole, was not in the Arctic, but it was in Hudson Bay in Canada. And because of that, all of us here on the East Coast, we are under a mile of ice. Why? Because we are in the polar zone. The polar zone wasn't the Arctic Circle at that time. It was a region centered in Hudson Bay. And so what happened was when the hypothesis is that when the poles shifted, Northern Canada was shifted from the polar zone to the temperate zone. And that's why all the ice melted. I mean, there's ice in Northern Canada, but, you know, where I live here in the Boston area, we're under a mile of ice that began melting 20,000 years ago. Why? Again, the most logical reason is not that the Earth's climate as a whole warmed by, they said, 10 degrees or so, but because this part of the world was shifted out of the polar zone into the temperate zone. And I apologize. I'm covering kind of a lot of ground and not necessarily the most logical way, but
that's the point.
There are a series of cataclysms that occurred. You know, Plato's Atlantis is perhaps one case that, came down to us through oral tradition, and there's others, Maori flood tradition and stories in New Zealand and in the South Pacific. And there's flood myths, and of course, the Sumerians and Zoroastrians have their own flood myths, and so
they do.
Anyway, these are all connected. They're all connected. Basically,
another little break right here. So we're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Have you ever read Communion? Or have you never read Communion? It's out in a new edition. Very powerful, a subtly new cover that reflects the fact that the visitors are now looking back at us because they truly are. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store as a Kindle, as a beautiful, sumptuous paperback, or as an unabridged audiobook read by me. It's the first time in the whole life of Communion that it has been read in full in audio format. And believe you me, I felt that reading. I put my life, my memories into it, and I trust you can hear it in the voice. I sure felt it while I was reading. So get Communion, listen to it, read it. Communion is of central importance to all of our lives.
You know, what you're talking about right now, when we're talking to Mark Carlotto, his books Before Atlantis and many others, go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and just search on Mark Carlotto, and you're going to find a treasure trove of extraordinary work. This is a brilliant man and an excellent writer. I could not put Before Atlantis down. It's my Kindle is filled with notes and things, and you can see every few pages you got that all that yellow stuff. This is me taking notes. Now,
very kind, thank you.
And you can meet him at markcarlotto.com as well and get into his work. And it's uniquely well organized and very well well thought out work, and a departure from the conventional wisdom for sure. And yeah. Mark is a very, very well put together rebel, a little bit like Graham Hancock in that respect. Now, we're in a situation right now. I mean, we're seeing the magnetic pole moving. We are seeing the sea levels rise. So, what's in store for us now?
So, you know, there's a lot of charts in my books, and one of the charts shows the global sea level changes over the last 100,000 years. And I think I have another one that shows it over the last 200,000 years. And they're kind of like, they're very similar. I mean, you've heard the expression that history doesn't repeat, it rhymes, right?
Yes.
It's sort of like there's a certain pattern or periodicity in the way the global sea levels change. And again, that's related to the amount of polar ice. So over the last 100,000 years, the sea levels were much lower because there was much more ice. And then, you know, 20,000 years ago, it melted. You go back 200,000 years, you have sort of the same pattern. There's no reason to think it's not going to repeat again. And so, you know, we could be, even though we're, you know, facing global warming, if the poles shifted and, you know, we were suddenly thrust into the back into the polar zone, you know, there'd be, again, formation of glaciers in Massachusetts here where I live. You know, so anyway, it's the relevance is that this is not something that has happened in the past and it may not happen again in the future. I think based on the cycles, and I'm a believer in cycles going back to, you know, ancient Vedic traditions. We talk about, you know, universal cycles. You know, I think it's, you know, bound to repeat again, particularly now with the geomagnetic anomalies that are occurring. Someone once asked me, you know, is it like next year or next couple of years? I said it could be in the next 1,000 years, but, you know, who knows? I'm sure we won't be here. There are other things that we worry about more these days than pole shifts.
Well, absolutely, we sure do, and with good reason, because I think pole shifts are a bit of an outlier. Now that I say that, we'll probably have one tonight. But in any case, they wake up in the morning, suddenly it's all cold, and then the sun goes past in the sky over about a 10-minute period. And you know, you're in trouble of some kind.
Yeah, something's happened. Yeah,
something's happening. You know, I remember back in the old days when there was nothing but internet relay chat. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Remember the conversation that went on about Mars and that incredible post by one of the members of that chat group? I forgot his name. It's been too long.
John Brandenburg, maybe.
It wasn't John, but it could have been easily. And it was it started out Mars was murdered.
That's John. Remember? Yeah,
it was John. Yeah, I've had John on the show, and he's certain. And what's so fascinating is he has reason to be sure that there was a that there was a or something happened on Mars that left a large nuclear area. Event.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead, a nuclear event. About. Yeah, yeah. John, you know, John and I work together quite a bit, different disciplines, but he, you know, again, sort of common interest in these anomalies, and you know, it's like, well, what happened to them? And his theory is that there was a nuclear event. Was it a bomb? I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone really knows, but it was vast, and it was over the northern hemisphere. You know, and I think his hypothesis is that it kind of blew the atmosphere away. That was it. That was the end.
You know, I want to tell you a story, and some of my listeners have heard this story before, but it's definitely going to creep you out. We got a lot of letters, and I'm not sure that this letter is anywhere in our files anymore, but it could be. It was from a lady in Tennessee who was out walking in the woods with her son. And suddenly, a little man, as she put it, came out of a cave and said he was a rebel, and he wanted to tell her the truth. And the truth is, he said, there was a war between Earth and Mars many, many thousands of years ago. And we destroyed Mars's atmosphere and the surface of Mars. But they won the war because they captured our souls. And they will never let us die and never let us escape. We are prisoners here. And condemned to always, after the body dies, to recur in another body and never leave this place. And he said, in our language, our name for Earth is Dead Forever.
Hmm.
Now, if that is not scary, and if you...
That's a little dark.
I don't know that's what...
That actually takes my mind off of election day. That's pretty dark.
Yeah. Oh, folks, we're recording this on election day. And, you know, I'm pretty sanguine about elections. Whatever happens, happens in my, you know, I'm very oriented toward the visitors. And, you know, they have their issues. And their issues are the danger of nuclear war and climate change. And the rest of it, you know, I don't think about it. I know the Trump and Harris are running, but by the time you see this, you'll know who's president, or will have been some kind of a revolution that I'm personally, I'll just keep out of the way, like I always have all my life. Okay, but let's go on with the story, because what if that story is true? And you know, if you look back into the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita, you do see a lot of stuff about wars in space. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, as allegory, that also I think has some relevance to, you know, what they talk about in the Gita and the other, you know, other Vedic texts is, you know, this idea that we're in this We're in this cycle of life and death. And, you know, it's our karma. If our karma is good, we come back and we're rewarded. If not, we're punished. But there's really no way to escape this. There actually are ways, but it's more in esoteric traditions. But that, you know, resonates, I think, with, you know, with the story that you just, or this person told about, you know, Earth and Mars. So. Yeah, I never heard that one. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, no one's ever heard it because she just sent it in a letter to me and Anne. And, you know, I've quoted it a number of times. And as I say, I don't know if it's in the archive at Rice University of our letters, because they haven't all been digitized yet. So we'll find it if it exists. But it was very telling, and especially because of the fact that it came in. We had this discussion on internet relay chat about Mars being murdered, and you know, and there's a, in the Dick Hoagland points out that there's a something struck the base of the D&M pyramid in Sidonia and collapsed the pyramid from within. And, you know, this is true. Of course, if we do send people to Mars and NASA has anything to do with it, if that's true, we won't find out. Which gets me to another question. Why do they do this? I mean, what's the point of if there's obviously something on Mars they don't want us to see, and the moon, or they wouldn't be airbrushing things. And there's airbrushed a lot of stuff. This man showed me dozens of images that have been airbrushed, not just one or two, but dozens. And what is it about? What are they hiding? You have any idea, Mark?
Do I have any idea?
Why would they hide things on Mars? What
you know, I think, Willie, I think it's sort of like human nature. It's sort of like, it's like the, you know, some of us, some people fear, they fear the unknown. They fear change. They refuse to accept facts that suggest they're changing, that you need to embrace a new way of looking at things or whatever. You know, life has changed, but people resist that. And, you know, I think, scientists are people. And so you have those that are in established positions, and by far this is the majority, and they want to keep things the way it is, because they, you know, it's a safe way of getting, you know, grant money and tenure and so forth. And to make, you know, to study anomalies, so-called anomalistic science, is, if you go on Wikipedia, this anomalistic science is the same thing as fake science, pseudoscience. There's absolutely no respect for it in the scientific community. You know, you read Thomas Kuhn, which is the, you know, scientific theory of scientific revolution, or I forget the title of it.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it's called.
Something like that. You know, that's at the very foundation of science, and how science expands and develops, and how we learn. Yet, can you hear all that yelling and screaming? Hopefully not.
No, we can't. Don't worry about it.
Okay. It's just a little distracting to me. Anyways. Because I'm forgetting about what I'm talking about. Anyway, I think
Kuhn.
So.
We're talking about Thomas Kuhn and his.
Kuhn, yeah. So I think, you know, just coming full circle back to this, I think it's just sort of human nature at work. You know, there are those of us that do not, that are, you know, I would say we do not fear. We all have some fear, but we're less fearful. We're more curious, and we're more willing to look at things differently for the possibility that maybe we'll learn something new. And, you know, I think this is what it's all about. And, you know, it's a challenge. Could we take a break?
Because our third and final break right now, folks. We're talking to Mark Carlotto. His books, Before Atlantis, and many others, incredibly interesting stuff. Do visit him on Barnes & Noble or Amazon. We'll be right back.
This is a brief excerpt from an interview with two contactees who had an 11-day close encounter experience and are now willing to speak about it, really, for the first time. To hear their whole interview and many others, subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Here's the excerpt. Did you see the man's face?
Yes. Actually, that one is very clear to me. It was kind of longish, and he didn't look completely human, but he... because he had very, very thin hair, almost non-existent, but he was young. I believe that it was kind of blonde. And he was very tall, like at least six feet. And he was so thin that he looked kind of strange.
And what happened then?
Well, he wanted me to go with him, or to stay with him. He wanted me to stay with him on the ship. And I'd been married for 6 months, and I wasn't about to go running off to stay on the ship.
Now, surely you want more. You must want more. And there is more. Not only this contactee interview, but many others, many of them just as extraordinary, on unknowncountry.com, plus everything else that we offer, my audio books, the meditations, the talks on the key, William Henry's wonderful revelation show and its entire run, Ann Streber's brilliant and magical mysterious powers, and so much more. Hours and hours of listening pleasure. Learn from the meditations on the site. Really learn, because they're real and they're valuable. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com right now. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on the subscribe tab. We are running very low on new subscribers now, and that should not be. It should not be happening. So you do it. You go there and you do it today.
We're talking to Mark Carlotto and having quite a journey between wars between Earth and Mars and pole shift and very, very ancient human habitation civilizations. What would they have been like? And, you know, Graham Hancock and I are close friends. We've been friends for many years. And I was in England with him and Santa at their place in Bath, as we call it, a few weeks ago. And then we got together here again in California when they were touring for their new TV series on Netflix. Mm. And we were talking about where was this civilization? And Graham's idea is that, you know, sea levels were at least 400 feet lower than they are now during the Pleistocene, the Ice Age. And they rose really suddenly. And it's extraordinary. When the Laurentide ice sheet collapsed, there were fantastic tsunamis all over this planet. And there are geological realities. We can find the traces of the tremendous damage that they did. And this civilization was eradicated. And it was probably a coastal civilization. Why wouldn't it have been? So all we have actually left are what was in the uplands and in the highlands. Mm. Is that a reasonable theory to you? Or do you have, I know Hapgood had a specific place and it was moved, someone who moved it to Antarctica figured out it was probably in Antarctica.
It was Rand Flem Ath wrote a book where he proposed that Antarctica, Atlantis is in Antarctica. Yeah.
And we're going to find that out, unfortunately, because I think a lot of Antarctica is going to melt in our lifetimes, or in your lifetime. Yeah. Anyway. It's hard to believe that I'm nearly 80 years old, but because I don't feel that way at all. And I, you know, like today, I got up at 6, swam for an hour, came back here, had a quick light breakfast. Now I'm talking to you, and do I feel tired? Old? Absolutely not. I'll go on until midnight. I'll get up again at 3 and meditate. And that'll be the way my day is every day. So,
I mean, 80 is the new 60, right?
Well, in my case, I feel it's the new 50.
Even better.
Even better. Exactly.
So you asked about these prior civilizations, and you know, this, you know, we have the fossil record that appears to show, you know, humankind developing, like the archaeologists and anthropologists say, you know, in a very gradual way. And then there's, you know, suddenly things explode, 10,000 BC, Göbekli Tepe and, you know, Eastern and Turkey. And, you know, we're finding, there's, I'm sure, going to be anomalies everywhere. But, you know, how does this happen? It must have been something before that. What I've tried to do in Before Atlantis is, rather than try to solve everything, you just sort of kind of bracket it and say, okay, let's leave out the whole extraterrestrial hypothesis. Let's assume that this is just, you know, humans being human. And you know, Graham Hancock talks about, you know, we're a species with amnesia. Well, it's certainly possible after a cataclysm, any high knowledge, advanced knowledge would have been forgotten because we're going to be more concerned with getting our, you know, our meals and keeping warm and surviving. And over time, you know, this, you know, if it happened now, our, you know, we probably would all die because we can't do anything except go on our mobile devices. So, yeah, so
if we lose the satellites, we lose our world. That's how we are very, very fragile because we've become so electronic and so dependent on basically a system of satellites. And, you know, I mean, I get spaceweather.com alerts every day. The solar max we're in now is way more powerful than anything that anybody imagined it would be. And I think to myself, you know, we've had a seven X flares, the highest we've had in this solar max so far. But there was a time in 1853 where we had a 45. If we had a 45 now, our civilization would end just like that.
So, you know, I think the possibility that that's happened with, you know, if there was a crustal shift, so meaning the whole skin of the earth moves, causing volcanic eruptions, other kinds of events, floods and so forth, it's not unlikely that evidence of our civilization, which is really just on the surface, would be washed away, would be cut over. You know, in archaeology, the oldest things are the deepest. So maybe if we dig down deep enough, we'll find evidence. But, you know, again, there's got to be sort of a passion to do that. And there's certainly no passion or interest in the archaeological community. They think that it's just a bunch of nonsense. But, you know, I'd love to get that device that Musk developed that, you know, bores holes, just start going someplace like in Jordan around Baalbek, or is that Lebanon, and just start digging down to see what's under the ancient foundations there, because they have no clue who built those foundations. They're pre-Roman. They're definitely not Roman.
Oh, they're done. They're not Roman. The Romans could move a 60-ton block with their equipment. Not a 1,000-ton block.
Yeah.
Not something that weighed 2 million pounds. Not even close. Let alone cut it, because they didn't have the saws that were.
Yeah.
So, but here, you know, there's so much weird stuff. My God, Baalbek. No foundation between on the causeway between the quarry and the monument and the platform. So with no foundation, that ground is not strong enough. It would have you couldn't have dragged the stones along it long. If they would have become embedded in the earth, but that didn't happen. And yet there's no sign of any foundation on the causeway at all. None. So therefore, they were not moved by being dragged. There was something else that had to have been done.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah.
No, that's okay. I just want to finish my laundry list here. The saws, I've already mentioned that. The causeway, the sheer size of the stones, we couldn't move them now without heavy, heavy equipment. But where is the heavy equipment that they used? Where's any of their tools? Where's any of it?
Right. Let me just, as an aside, let me mention that Baalbek, the Western Wall in Jerusalem, the Parthenon, the Acropolis in Athens, they all are closely aligned with the Greenland Pole. This is the pole that would have existed between 75,000 and 130,000 years ago. So again, these are sites whose alignments cannot be explained. I remember searching, I remember doing a literature search to see, okay, what are the astronomical sort of theories for Baalbek? There are none. They can't find anything that it was aligned to, but it points to the Greenland Pole. So anyways, that attests indirectly, circumstantially to a vast age for these structures way before, not even the previous civilization, one of the earlier civilizations during the last ice age.
Yeah, you know, exactly. At this and whatever happened here, I think, excuse me while my iPad falls apart, I think that it was so disruptive and so catastrophic that I agree with Graham and Barbara Hand Clow, and probably you. We are in amnesia. We are literally in a state of amnesia about our own past. We can't look at it because it is so terrifying. And this is somewhere in our genes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's somewhere in our genes.
Yeah, I mean, it maybe it's somewhat analogous to, you know, if you're a believer in sort of Eastern mysticism, spirituality, you know, the idea that our souls transmigrate the body, you know, our evolution is that of the soul, from body to body, life to life. And, you know, we don't, most people, Edgar Cayce might have been an exception, but most of us don't remember our past lives. In the same way, maybe we don't remember, humanity doesn't remember its past ages. In a sort of
metaphor, I bet you're right.
Yeah.
Listen, we got to say goodbye to our free Dreamlanders, and we're going to keep going on the subscriber side. Subscribers, free Dreamlanders, excuse me, thank you for being with us. Before Atlantis and many other books, including incredibly cool books on Mars, Mark Carlotto, the original, originally studied the Sidonia face and so forth, a major figure in this field. Don't miss his work. It's quite extraordinary. We'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.